Hi, everyone. Quick plug before we get started. As many of you probably already know who listen to this podcast, we've launched an app. It's called Vivio. It tracks your sleep, nutrition, exercise, and mindset and gives you individualized recommendations on a daily basis on how to get healthier, to improve your well-being, and to perform to your potential. So if you want to check it out, visit vivio.com, V-I-I-V-I-O.com. Thanks so much. Let's dive into this episode. Everyone, welcome back. Great to have you here again for another episode of the podcast. Really excited to talk exercise training today. It is hot. It is summer in the Northern Hemisphere, and we are outdoors doing as much as we possibly can, which means long, for me, long bike rides, long hikes, long climbs outside in the sun, in the heat. And to that end, I became once again hyper aware about hydration and fueling and electrolytes. So reached out to Andy Blow to talk a little bit more about this. Andy is a sports scientist and the founder of Precision Hydration. He was formerly an elite level triathlete who can count a couple of top 10 Ironman finishes and an Xterra age group world title to his name. It was during his racing career that he discovered how individualized fluid and electrolyte replacement can make a big difference to performance. And that led him to setting up precisionhydration.com, a company that specializes in sweat, dehydration, cramping, electrolyte replenishment, and helping athletes better understand their own hydration needs. And he has a BSc degree in sport and exercise science from the University of Bath, UK, and he currently lives in Christchurch, Dorset, in the UK with his wife, Lucy, and their two young children, Bobby and Bethany. Andy has worked with F1 drivers. He's worked with Major League Baseball players. He's worked with top tennis players. So he has the experience necessary to help us understand this topic at the highest possible level. So let's dig into it. Please enjoy my conversation with sports scientist and hydration expert, Andy Blow. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm so awesome. Currently still in the mountains. I understand you're on the south coast of the UK. How are things going? Like, tell us about where you're at. What's been going on?
Yeah, well, we're coming out of the pandemic winter, aren't we? And the sun is shining here today, which is great. We're back in the office, working flat out, super busy, and yeah, all sorts going on. Just trying to keep out of trouble.
Nice. So let's go back to the beginning. Let's do the origin story. How did you get involved in physical activity and exercise? Like, what's the origin story? Just so everyone can get to know you a little bit better.
Yeah, for sure. I grew up in a super active family. My dad especially really encouraged me and my brother to play sport. And because we're from the UK, we played football, soccer, you know. And the way it gets told is that I was definitely better at running without a ball at my feet than with a ball at my feet. So did better at cross-country running and I did a bit of swimming. So I was kind of started to gravitate towards endurance athletics at a young age. And I was never that good, but I was pretty determined, and for some reason I think about it a lot. I don't know why, but it lit a fire in me. I really got something back from it, so kept doing it, and I found triathlon and then got super immersed in triathlon for years. Wanted to go to the Olympic Games, because in 2000 that was all the talk, and I went to a university to study sports science where I could train for triathlon with the what was going to be the sort of GB Olympic team. And I was decent, but I wasn't good enough to ever make that team up. I was in the training squad, and that ended up then leading me into sort of doing Ironman triathlon, where I raced sort of professionally, semi-professionally for a bit. Again, not to a brilliant standard. I knocked around the top 10, got a couple of podiums in races and things, but was always sort of, you know, like a try hard, you know, always just kind of giving it all I'd got. And it was in that doing that, that I learned about sweat and hydration a little bit, because I was really struggling I would do well in cold conditions, and obviously a lot of triathlons are in the heat, and I have a huge sweat rate. And then I was just flaking in hot races. I went to Kona and did the Ironman, terrible performance, performed really badly in the Middle East and in Asia when it was hot and humid. And a friend of mine who was a doctor looked at me and said, look at the amount of like salt on your kit and your skin. We need to get you sweat tested because I think you're losing tons of sodium and electrolytes. Mm-hmm. And that kickstarted a process. I had a sweat test. My numbers are like super high. I lose loads of sodium in my sweat. I started to look into that. I found out there's this huge sort of physiological range between different people. And then correcting that with a nutritional intervention, which for me was drinking a bit less fluid, taking a lot more salt in races, was like night and day. It was the difference. You know, all of a sudden I felt like I could compete on a par in the heat with where I should be. And that, so alongside all of that happening, I was working a little bit in sports science and coaching. I worked in motorsport with Formula One athletes doing their physical training. Then I got into the triathlon coaching side of things, set up a sports science lab, and we started doing sweat testing as part of the protocol we used to assess athletes, because I thought if this was helpful to me, then maybe this will be helpful to other people. And then that's kind of the period, what I've just described there, is between like the late 90s and about 2008. And then around 2009, 2010, the sweat testing stuff was becoming quite popular. And we decided, okay, this could be, you know, brought to athletes as its own entity. And we launched Precision Hydration, which is the company, in 2011. And basically sort of, I've been on a rambling journey of growing that for the last 10 years and all the ups and downs you get of trying to start a startup and all that kind of thing.
Okay, pretty cool background. Got some questions. Let's start with the physiology of sweat, shall we? Just because that's, yeah. I mean, I gravitate towards that. As soon as I can talk about the human body, I'm like, I'm all in. So let's talk about sweat in terms of H2O versus sodium, like sweat of water, sweat of electrolytes, and have a bit of understanding of both of those. Like, let's just start with like, why do we sweat? How does that happen? Let's just understand that a little bit better.
So sweating is the human body's way of cooling. Because we evaporate sweat from the surface of our skin, and it takes away a lot of heat. If you think about the best way to think about the sensation is when you are on a hot day, sat by the outdoor swimming pool, you jump in the pool, you get out, and that instantaneous feeling of like it suddenly feels cold, that's the very quick evaporation of a lot of water from your skin. And sweating is kind of just our body dripping water onto the surface of our skin to evaporate heat away. Most other animals, incidentally, don't sweat. They pant or they lose heat through other mechanisms. So, you know, horses sweat a little bit, camels sweat a little bit, dogs maybe sweat through their paws, but they don't sweat anywhere near as much as we do. So humans sweat like way, way more than any other creature. And it's thought that we evolved in Africa on the savannah, and that sweating gave us a competitive advantage because it enabled us to persistence hunt and chase down prey that we couldn't catch by speed, but we could catch it by endurance. So we could kind of out endure an antelope or a gazelle or something like that by moving in the heat of the day, sweating and cooling off while these poor creatures were running to heat exhaustion. That's the kind of theory about why sweating became a human trait, because it gave us this competitive advantage. And of course, what that does in modern life is, where if you want to catch an antelope, there are easier ways than, you know, spending 6 hours running it down. Now we've turned that into an ability to do the Ironman or an ultramarathon, or humans are like basically the best endurance animals on the planet, pretty much. So that's kind of why we sweat. How we sweat is, in your brain, the hypothalamus is monitoring core body temperature, amongst other things, all the time. And to maintain homeostasis and balance in your core body temperature, you release hormones and signaling molecules to the sweat glands that turn your sweating response on when your internal thermostat gets to a certain level. So it preempts you getting too hot by causing you to sweat. And your sweat is actually part of your blood. It comes from your blood plasma, the watery part of your blood. Hence the fact that in your sweat, we lose a lot of electrolytes, because blood is very salty. It's very rich in electrolytes. And this, although the sweat glands can reclaim some of the electrolytes that we lose before the water is ejected onto the skin, you know, the sort of technical term is that sweat is hypotonic to blood. Isotonic would be the same. Hypotonic is lower in electrolytes. The level of hypotonicity, how much lower it is than your blood, depends on the ability of your particular sweat glands to reclaim more or less electrolytes. To put some numbers behind that, you know, the the range that we see when you measure human sweat, some people will have very dilute sweat and they'll lose as little as 200 milligrams of sodium in every liter of sweat. Some people will lose over 2000 milligrams of sodium in every liter of sweat. And in the middle of that curve, the bell curve of distribution that we see is about 950 milligrams, which is kind of the average. And you see a very typical normal distribution there, which means that a lot of people are in the middle of that range. A few people are very light on the amount of sodium they lose. And a few, like myself, I'm up at 1800 or so milligrams normally, are very heavy. And that appears to be, although there is controversy to a degree, not controversy, but there's questions around this, like it appears to be quite genetically driven. There are environmental acclimatization and dietary factors that can push your sweat sodium numbers around a little bit. But fundamentally, the amount of sodium that your sweat glands reabsorb or don't appears to have some kind of genetic component. When they've done biopsy studies, they've found that, you know, people have lower abundance of the channels that reabsorb the electrolyte ions if they exhibit higher sweat sodium losses. So that's why, that's when I learned about all of this and thought, well, if people are all across this spectrum, this is like super useful information for an athlete to know if they're going to do long and hot and hard, arduous things. Because whilst your sweat losses over an hour or two might not be drastically different from someone else, if you spread that out over 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours or more, especially in the heat when your sweat rate's really high, the net fluid and electrolyte difference or loss in losses can be absolutely massive. It kind of all leads to this idea that basically on that basis, there's no one size fits all fluid replacement, electrolyte replacement guideline that works for everyone. You've got to individualize it to an extent.
Got it. Again, tons of questions. So before we get into sort of the nutritional strategies, I'd love to know about, so let me give you the context. 2003, you know, finished my PhD, went to Cairo, Egypt, and joined the Tour d'Afrique to cycle down to Cape Town, South Africa, which meant that, you know, I joined them in Khartoum because I was a few days late. So I fly into Khartoum, Sudan, which in and of itself was an insane experience. But anyway, the next day I went from Toronto, which was in February, which was minus 20. And when we landed in Khartoum, Sudan, and started cycling on the very first day, it was plus 52 degrees Celsius through the Sahara Desert. And the first day was 170K of cycling. So a little over 100 miles. And I was so shattered at the end of that day. I came into camp. I also overshot camp and I missed the turnoff to go to camp and ended up in some Sudanese jail in the middle of the Sahara Desert. And the inmates turned me around and sent me back. But anyway, but I got to camp and I was like so covered in salt. Like my shirt was white. The straps of my backpack were like, I could literally just like brush off the salt. My face was white. My hair, like it was just, my helmet was covered in salt. But 2 weeks later, once we'd gotten through every single day, 100K, 150K rides, 3 weeks later, I was totally fine. Absolutely no problems whatsoever. At least when it came to hydration, there was other issues that came up at that time, but I adapted. So I'm curious about how do we adapt to, how does our sweat rate, our sweat composition adapt to endurance training? And how does it adapt to heat exposure? Because I imagine that those are two different mechanisms that train us to be able to exercise, you know, as you say, we're the ultimate endurance animal on the planet. And so how do we adapt to get there from an endurance perspective and from a heat exposure perspective? I'd love to understand what happened to me out in the desert.
Yeah, it's a good question. And what you experienced there was obviously like one of the rudest shocks you can give to your physiology from a temperature extreme point of view, that going from that cold environment to then the heat. And as you found out though, as well, the good thing is your body adapts really well to the heat. You know, the human body can, it usually takes about the sort of literature, classic literature statement is 14 days or so to fully acclimatize to the heat. Although you get the vast majority of the, you probably get 80%, the old 80-20 rule kicks, and you get probably 80% of those gains in the first 4 or 5 days. And they're things like your blood volume increases. So you get more plasma volume to pump more blood around the body. You start sweating. So the onset of sweating is earlier because your internal thermostat resets. So because the body realizes that you're going to get hot quickly, or thinks it is based on recent prior experience, the thermostat comes down. So you start sweating earlier and you start sweating more vigorously. So your sweat rate increases. So you lose more fluid, which sounds like it would be counterintuitive because wouldn't you want to conserve fluid? But actually the priority is like you'll die of heat stroke faster than you'll die of dehydration. So your body prioritizes losing heat before conserving water on the basis that hopefully you'll find a drink, you know, to top that back up again. Now, interestingly as well, one thing that you've obviously noticed is, you know, there is a level of an adaptation in sweat electrolyte loss as well. And the literature suggests that can be up to maybe 30% reduction in sweat sodium losses. What we found is really interesting is that in trained athletes, we don't very often see a drop of that much of a magnitude. And part of that could be because when you do regular endurance training, although you're not necessarily exposing yourself to a hot environment, you are raising your core temperature. Even if you go for a run on a very cold day in cold conditions, you will sweat. You know, if you run hard enough, you raise your core body temperature. And to an extent, your body doesn't discriminate too much between whether that heat acclimation is from internal heat production or external heat. There are subtle differences, but essentially, as an endurance athlete, if you're highly trained, you are already in a slightly adaptive state. You know, you are partway heat acclimated, even if you've not been training in the heat itself. So that's one of the theories that we sort of use to explain this fact that when we test and retest lots of athletes with their sweat sodium, like, for example, I'll go to pre-pandemic, I would spend most of February in hot weather. So I would go to Arizona and Florida because we do a lot of work with Major League Baseball in the US. So I would spend the month of February, like 2 weeks running around in Phoenix and 2 weeks running around in Florida. And I go for a run every day when I'm there pretty much and do some exercise. And when I sweat test myself before and after I go and along the way, because I'm often doing demonstrations of our kit and things, and my numbers will come down a little bit over that period of time, but not by a lot, maybe by 5 or 8%. Although that could be deemed significant, what it isn't for me, it doesn't take me from being a high salt losing guy to a low salt losing guy. And in some respects, the increase in the sweat rate counteracts some of the difference anyway, because the total net sodium loss that you experience is higher because you sweat more. So, but all of those things and tons of other little adaptations, there's adaptations around what's called heat shock proteins that improve your tolerance, your overall tolerance of the heat. And a massive one as well is just the psychological adaptation to the heat. The first day when we call it the getting off the plane when you go on vacation thing, you know, you kind of walk out, you're like, whoa, this heat is hits you. You feel claustrophobic, especially if it's humid. Yet within 48 hours, you're absolutely loving it.
Yeah.
It's just that first, you know, that. And that's why for athletes who want to acclimatize to a hot environment, we always say, even if you can't go to the environment, even if you can go and sit in a sauna or go and do some homespun heat exposure, well, obviously in a safe and controlled manner, then you can at least get the psychological adaptation, even if you're not going to drive massive physiological adaptations before you go away.
Love it. I really do need to get someone in to talk about heat shock proteins. Maybe we can dig into that in a future episode, but let's dig into now. Okay, you're out, you're exercising, and you're sweating. I've broken that out into hydration, electrolytes, and fuel. How do we make sure that we are exercising? And let's assume that people listening today might be going from, you know, I'm going out for a walk consistently, or maybe I'm playing golf, or a significant percentage of people listening are also training for events. So we can, you know, sort of go up into that zone. Someone might be training for a triathlon, a 10K, a marathon, an Ironman, whatever that happens to be. From a perspective of like making sure that we're consuming the right liquids and fuel during exercise, what are we thinking when it comes to hydration, electrolytes, and maybe then we'll get into fuel later. Let's just do electrolytes and hydration right now. What's a good strategy, or what could people be thinking about when it comes to doing that optimally? As you said, there's a range from people who sweat from 200 milligrams through to 2000 milligrams per liter, but, you know, 950 being the middle. Let's, you know, sort of explore that. What would people typically want to be doing when it comes to hydrating and staying in a good place from the perspective of electrolytes during exercise?
Yeah, it's a very good and common question we get asked, and it's one of those massive it depends answers, really, because there's a lot of variables to consider. But what if we start from an easy one and say, look, for the vast majority of people, if you're training relatively moderately, if you're doing less than an hour to 90 minutes of exercise, then ensuring you're well hydrated before you start is important and helpful. So, you know, not turning up dehydrated, basically. And then you will either thrive or in fact just muddle through with very little intake, you know. And there is an argument that in extremely hot conditions, if you have an extremely high sweat rate, then certainly within 90 minutes you might benefit from drinking and taking on some electrolytes. But that's their edge cases. For the majority of people, if you're most of the stuff that you do is like an hour or less, then you can just, you know, drink when you're thirsty, make sure you're turning up hydrated. If you feel like putting a bit of salt on your food afterwards, because it was a sweaty workout and that helps you replace some electrolytes, great. Then, and I think that certainly covers a lot of people a lot of the time. Once you start to go beyond the horizon of 2-3 hours, and especially if it's getting heat, you see this big sort of like sudden deviation between the low and the high people, because every hour that goes on is a multiplier on that rate of loss. So to give you a really current example, because it's in my head and it's an extreme one, we've just been doing some work and I'm doing ongoing work with a professional tennis player who sadly actually just got knocked out of Wimbledon, but who's back in his base in Florida training. And this dude sweats like 4.5 liters an hour. I've never seen anything like it. And I didn't believe the numbers when I first heard the numbers, but I've seen them now and the numbers are right. And he drinks like 2 liters an hour when he's practicing and still comes off the court significantly dehydrated. So by going all the way to that extreme, you can say, look, for people like that, they need a very strategic, high sodium, high fluid replacement regime going on, because otherwise they do just suffer, you know, cramping, low blood volume, low blood pressure, impaired recovery, poor cardiovascular performance, decreased heat tolerance, all of the stuff that results from your blood volume diminishing. Because at the heart of it, dehydration, electrolyte depletion really hits blood volume the hardest. You know, that's where we feel it. But if we wind back from there, like you've got kind of every shade of gray through to white before that, because there are players or athletes that can go out and do 2-3 hours on a single bottle of water. You know, maybe not from a fueling perspective, because carbohydrate needs tend to kick in after, you know, 90 minutes or so. But, and I'm not trying to evade the question of like giving you numbers, but it totally depends on like it's horses for courses. And the advice, you know, there's been a lot of advice in the last few years. So we go back 100 years ago, athletes were told to drink nothing. You go to you jump all the way forward to the 1990s, and people were advised to drink as much as they could, you know, as much as you can tolerate was the actual phrase, I think, that was used in the 1996 American College of Sports Medicine guidelines. Of course, off the back of that, we saw lots of cases of hypernatremia with people diluting their blood sodiums and overdrinking. So then the latest crusade has been the drink to thirst thing, which is like, okay, just listen to your body, respond to the cues of thirst, and you'll be fine. And I do think that that's very sensible advice for people who are doing moderate or short duration activities. I do think it's terrible advice if you're doing long activities and sweat a lot in the heat, because you tend to end up more dehydrated or more compromised before you actually arrest the fall, unless you've got experience. And what experience teaches you is to drink earlier and drink more. So that's the kind of it is about evaluating, dispassionately evaluating the sweat load of your event multiplied by your particular physiology, and then from there, I'm making it sound really scientific, but it's just then trial and error. It's just like, okay, what works for me? I know now intuitively, because I've got 30 years of experience riding my bike, that when I go out for 2 hours, if the weather feels a bit like this, is this a one bottle day or a two bottle day? And what needs to go in those bottles? And I think, you know, I'm sure you'll be the same, though. When you've built up a database of experience to draw on, you usually get it about right. But the process of getting that right has involved a lot of error in that trial. And what we try to do with the numbers that we put forward to athletes is encourage them to understand the guardrails. It's like, okay, Greg, you seem like a 500 to 1,000 milliliters an hour guy in the warm weather. Let's go and play with that and see how it plays out, you know, in the field. And it's the same with the electrolytes. You know, when we do the sweat test, a lot of people early on, especially, the perception was, oh, these guys are going to test my sweat and tell me exactly what I need to drink. It's like, hang on a minute, that's not how it works. You know, we can then put you in a bucket a small, medium, large, extra large bucket, or a high, low, moderate, high, very high bucket. And we can tell you what we think might work based on those characteristics, but you've got to go try it, because the human body is more clever and complicated than we can even hope to test for at the moment. We can test loads of individual funky data points that often get overblown. In reality, what you have to do is mix a bottle, tip it down your neck, and see what happens. You know,
yeah. The two Ironmans that I did, the first one felt like I was running around with, you know, 2 liters of water in my stomach, and that was horrible. So the marathon was excruciating. And the second one, I had it dialed because I tested a whole bunch of different things and it felt great. Like I could tell when I was getting a little dehydrated, just top up. I could tell when I was, you know, I could feel the electrolytes getting low, just top that up with a tab. And the outcome was completely different when it came to me being able to exercise in those different scenarios. So unfortunately, the trial and error does have to play some role in it, getting some data to help you move along. You know, that can help speed that process up a little bit, which leads me to the next thing. We've got a bit of an understanding now about hydration and electrolytes, setting up those guardrails and sort of managing, do I sweat a lot or do I sweat a little? Is my sweat full of sodium or not so much? We've got those guardrails set up. What about fueling and carbohydrate intake? Because that's another area of a lot of debate, and would love to know what you think about that. By the way, I also really appreciate the fact that you're clear that up to about an hour, we're fine with just following your thirst, drink some water, sprinkle some salt in your food. That matches up exactly with what we say. But beyond that, especially if you're in the heat, you do have to follow some of these strategies to make sure that you can do it at a high level and safely. So when it comes to fueling during exercise, would love your take on that as well, because that's super interesting for me. How do we keep ourselves energized throughout all of the things we want to do for maybe if it's longer than an hour?
Yeah, that's definitely an area where you're 100% right. There's an element of, you know, disagreement, controversy, and that sort of thing. But what I would say is that because it's probably an area where we're closer to agreement than we are around hydration, actually, when I talk to other professionals, that is the caveat to that is if you take the sort of the ultimate keto, low carb, you know, all the time warriors out of the equation, because that is a more of a sort of like singularly extreme viewpoint on, you know, low carb all the time, high fat, adapt and roll with it. Although there is definitely a place for that kind of diet in medicine, in general health for some people, even in maybe like, let's say like expeditions and things like that, where you've got to carry like loads of food. And what it's all about is like calories per gram and that sort of thing. Clearly being fat adapted, if you're maybe, I don't know, pulling a sledge across Antarctica or something, is you don't want to be carrying a sledge full of energy gels. You know, it's not going to work. If we go into the realm of like high performance sport, though, kind of aerobically testing like 60, 70, 80, 90% VO2 max type stuff, you know, like so triathlons, bike races, marathons, and all of that, the prevailing science and experience tells us that like carbohydrates, the main fuel that you need, that you've probably got enough on board for an hour. Between an hour and 90 minutes, there's maybe a marginal benefit to taking on some carbs, maybe 30 grams or something like that of carbohydrate. And then beyond that, you know, you get to two and a half hours, 30 grams is maybe going to keep you going, another 30 grams. Beyond that, 60 grams of carbs an hour starts to become more compatible with peak performance. And then beyond that, we're seeing lots of athletes taking 90, 100, 110, 120 even grams of carb per hour to really maintain a high output. And that's an area which is like emerging at the moment, where there's more literature being produced around these examples of athletes that are taking very high carbohydrate doses per hour. We work with a number of teams who are doing like Tour de France, and people are winning Ironman races and stuff, and definitely see 100 gram an hour plus as being relatively commonplace in those elite individuals, but not universal. There are guys in the Tour that are eating 70 gram carb an hour, as far as the data that I'm seeing. So there's a bit of a spread. But I think that generally a lot of athletes, I certainly grew up in an era where I don't know whether the message was being pushed to me or it was the way I interpreted it, was that it was good to go out and train on a little bit less food, because then when you had carbs on race day, it would kind of be, it would supercharge you. Mm. And definitely what I'm seeing with athletes now is more of a willingness to train on a higher carbohydrate fuel source some of the time, if not all of the time, then at specific sessions to try and improve tolerance and uptake of carbs, because that can then lead to bigger gains on race day. Because ultimately, if you can intake comfortably without gastric distress and tolerate higher amounts of carbohydrate, there's more exogenous fuel floating around in the system. You should be able to oxidize it better and perform at a higher, keep a higher output for longer.
Got it. You've been super kind to put together a ton of resources for everybody on this podcast. I just want to walk through them. Links to all of this will be in the show notes. So if you want to learn about the science of endurance hydration, you have a course on Training Peaks University. Is that correct?
We do, yeah. And that's a modular course that people can sign up for and actually like get into all of the topics around hydration.
Yeah. Awesome. Enter the code SWEAT457UXL when signing up, and that will give you access to that. I will put the link to that in the show notes, and I'd love to hear more about your new quick carb calculator so that people can use that online tool to figure out how much fuel they need when they're doing their workouts.
Yeah, that was something that we innovated in the last few months with all the questions we've been getting with athletes about, okay, well, how much fuel do I need for X or Y activity? So we built this kind of algorithm-driven thing. You can find it on the page on precisionhydration.com that houses the energy gels or the precision fuel drinks. It just says, how much carb do I need? Click the button and you're going to put in, okay, Greg, I'm doing a two-hour run at this intensity. How much carb am I going to need? And it just spits you out a quick number with a bit of text to explain how you might want to do that. And that we found has been, I think we, the other day when I checked, we'd had like 52 different countries, people from 52 different countries had clicked on that, which was a mind-blowing stat, you know. So the demand of people wanting to know that information is out there, and it's like a 10-second exercise. So I definitely encourage people to do that.
Super cool. You also gave everyone listening a discount code for everything at precisionhydration.com. That's Wells15. Thank you so much for doing that. That's super cool. First, that's actually a first on this podcast. So super psyched about that. But you also will do a one-on-one call with people, which has exploded during this pandemic as well. I think that the story behind that's kind of cool too, actually.
Yeah, well, we were going to the London Marathon in April of 2020, it would have been, wouldn't it? And obviously that didn't happen because of the first COVID lockdown in the UK. And so we sat around and we said, what are we going to miss from going to London? And the first thing that everyone said was, well, like talking to athletes, you know, that's what we go there to do. And so we said, well, why don't we put out in our newsletter video calls so we can talk to athletes and say, hey, we can't connect with you on the thing, but if you want to talk hydration, fueling, whatever, with us, book a 20-minute call for free on Google Hangouts and we'll chat to you. And it went bonkers. And so many people booked, we had to all do shifts around the clock, you know, to accommodate all these calls. And then it just carried on. And it's just been going on all year. So we've actually, you know, we've invested in technology, software, booking systems, and all the rest of it. The calls are free. You can come on, you can talk to one of the team at PH. You know, we prefer to talk about fueling and hydration. We have had chats about all sorts of things with people for 20 minutes, but yeah, hit us up if you want to have a chat and sort of, you know, talk through your fueling hydration strategies, because we'd love to do that.
Super cool. What's your vision for the future? Like, what are you guys working towards? What's your you know, mission? What's your purpose? Would just love to see, like, what's your vision for the future for you and for your company and for the listeners who are involved in endurance sport?
I think that's been ever evolving, but I've got a post-it note on my desk at the moment, which has the phrase, you know, like outcomes, not features on it. And that's about how we talk to people about what we do, because most companies in sports nutrition and a lot of other fields want to sell you a product with features and how cool that's going to be. Whereas our mission has always been that we started out as a consultancy to help athletes to be faster and have a better experience at what they do. And we've tried to maintain that through, you know, building online tools. So we're still building more sophisticated online tools to help people. We call it the three levers: fluid, sodium, carbs. We talked about them all quickly on this recording, but there, if you can get those numbers dialed for your events, then okay, you've still got to be fit enough, you've still got to pace it right, you've got to have the right equipment and stuff, but that is a huge element of your event covered off. And we take great pride in, if we every day we get emails from people saying how they've used that process to actually get their A race right. And of course, being athletes ourselves, you know how much time, money, emotional energy goes into training for your big thing. Our mission is basically to help you make sure that you didn't, if you screw it up, it wasn't the fault of your hydration or nutrition, you know.
Because I've done that, for the record, like I've done all of those mistakes I've made. Yeah. So it's good to try to get that out of the way so you can blame it on your training and not what was in your water bottle. So I personally appreciate that a ton. Cool. All right, Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. I'm going to put all of the links to these resources in the show notes for people. Obviously, tons more to dig into around all of this. So I super consider this just to be like an initial chat, get people started, and then we can dig into the details and some of the, you know, recent research in an upcoming call. I hope that you'll come back and chat to us again.
I would absolutely love to, Greg. Yeah, thanks for the invite.
All right, everyone. Hope that you enjoyed that. Loads of resources for you on this one from the team at Precision Hydration. So if you would like to get any hydration gels, electrolyte replacements, fluid powders, those sorts of things that you need to support your physical activity outdoors, check out precisionhydration.com. Use the code WELLS15 at checkout for 15% off. If you want to set up a free one-to-one call with one of the Precision Hydration team to talk about your own personal challenges and needs, check out precisionhydration.com, book a sweat expert call, and that's book-a-sweat-expert-call, and you can get that set up. It's also available on their website, precisionhydration.com, if you misspell that. Also, you can check out the Science of Endurance Hydration course at Training Peaks University. You can use the code PODCAST15 to get 15% off that as well. Links to the discount code at Precision Hydration, links to the free one-on-one calls, and the Science of Hydration course are in the show notes. You can check those out. And hopefully that helps you tremendously to exercise more in a safer way, especially when you're outdoors for long periods of time in the heat. All right, that's it for this week. If that was helpful, please leave us a review on iTunes. That helps a ton. Subscribe on whatever platform you get your podcasts, and feel free to message me on social at Dr. Greg Wells if you have any questions or comments. That's it for this week, everyone. Hope you have a great one. Talk to you soon.